Welcome to the Seeding Social Good podcast by Turnkey. I'm Katrina Van Hus, chair and founder of Turnkey, and this podcast is all about figuring out what works to help us all do more good faster.
How the design of your fundraising event impacts the relationships with your constituents. And so with us to talk about that today is Brian Carney. He's the CEO of Blue Sea Foundation in Ontario, and their signature event is called the Coldest Night of the Year. And welcome, Brian. Can you tell us a little bit about the Blue Sea Foundation?
Our first event was called The Ride for Refuge, and our second born was called Coldest Night of the Year, and that's the one that I think we're best known for in Canada, and now just a little bit in the United States. Yeah, Blue Sea has as a vision, a desire that's not on any PowerPoint or up on any wall. It's just tattooed on every staff as they come through the door to see a more generous world. So that's it. That's what drives us. That's our MO. And that's what we'll be doing. Yeah.
So, you know, most importantly, you are from Canada and your favorite beverage or your daytime beverage is, yes, Tim Hortons coffee.
Yeah. No, I on cue. Yes. Every time you buy a Tim Hortons coffee, a Canadian apologizes. So
I love it. Talk to us about your experience with COVID and potentially how it intersects with the language that Otis and I use an awful lot, which is social versus market relationships. And I'm going to pause you just a second. Otis, define social versus market relationships.
You know, psychologists talk about people being in two kinds of relationships. You know, there are social relationships that people have. And these are relationships when you ask someone, well, why are you doing this thing? Why are you donating? Why are you volunteering? Why are you helping your sister clean out her garage? They'll just say, well, you know, it's just the right thing to do. It's something that I believe in. And in a market relationship, by contrast, there's some kind of a transaction. Somebody's getting something for doing something. Psychologists often talk about behavior contingent rewards. And these are rewards that you get for doing something. So, you know, if you raise $1,000, you're going to get a cooler. That's a behavior contingent reward. And these are people that are in market relationships. They're getting something for doing something, in other words.
Okay, so Brian, back to you. Describe your condition before COVID, and then what happened during COVID, and then let's go after COVID. And you've promised us some juicy nugget of knowledge that you're going to disclose today. So go ahead.
Okay, well, actually, I would like to go back a long way to say that in the first 2 years of the very first event, when I knew nothing, zero, I looked at the other events in Canada that had any pedigree and tried to model myself after that. Now, this is an event, 25,000 the first year, 45,000 the second year, 85,000 in year three, a peer-to-peer event, riding your bike. That's all it was. And what I saw was, with all due respect to our good friends at CIBC Run for the Cure, is they had all these steps of reward for fundraising success. And so we modeled that. And it was at times absolutely idiotic what we were giving away. I was literally like, is that a thermos? Put a logo on it. And Katrina, I'm guessing to some small extent, you know that pain, as I read in both of your books.
Yes.
About that whole factory, it was in year number one, it was stupid. In year number two, I doubled down and added steps, and it was ridiculous as I was handing out this stuff to people who only wanted to help refugees. Like, I was just killing it for them. Like, no, have this thermos and this cool toque. And I get excited just thinking about how dumb that was. And, you know, it took a while to register that it just didn't matter. And actually, when we finally bought into a peer-to-peer online fundraising system, everything was analog, right, initially, it kind of forced our hands because we just accepted the default setting that at $150, you'd get a single piece of swag. And that's what we went with, as well as a $25 registration fee. So you asked about what pre-COVID was. Well, it's hard to back up 10 years of pre-COVID, but it wasn't at all market, because some of the things, again, that you wrote in chapter four, especially around the MS bike, we did quite honestly and authentically. We were like, yeah, we need this. We got some costs, but look at what you're doing, right? To our friends in Athens that are fleeing for their lives from Africa. And you can just connect the dots so well. And that's what the thing is about. And you're number three of the event, Canadian, absolute quintessential Canadian. We get this early snowstorm, right? And we had no rules. you're 5 years old on a bike, you're heading out into the snow. And I mean, it's coming down, the plows are out. We're like, no, we'll go. There was no guide then. It was just send them out like lambs to the slaughter. Anyways, so away they went. And that year too, you know, we learned that like the more they suffered, the more it meant. Right. Mm. And so we went out, like while they were out, we went out to a dollar store and got like tons of socks because everybody was soaked to the bone, and quickly got some hot cider for Mennonites at the 25K. That's about 14 miles or something like that for Americans, Mark, to have something warm at that end. And so we were loving them up. Right. Like we didn't know anything, but we were loving them up, and it was about the mission and what this thing was all about. But also at the end, here's your stuff. Go and be happy with your thermos that you'll never use again.
Yep.
So that was pre-COVID. And we were beginning to, and there were some other things we were bumping into, you know, around the reg fee. Like we're like many that are in this. I'm not unique. Blue Sea's not unique, but we are definitely data nerds when it comes to analyzing what's happening and some of the trends. And we started to see some concerning trends around it. And in 2017, your first book came out. I remember reading it at the beach in Florida and really enjoying it and thinking, oh, this is disruptive and also affirming to some decisions. And so going into COVID, as we did that turn, so COVID comes and, you know, as your good book says in chapter 4, we dodged the bullet because our event was end of February and March 16th or 17th closed down. And so the money was in. We got it out to our partners fast, and then we hunkered down and began to think about the ride and another event called the Grand Parade that we had that summer. And in those moments said, here's the opportunity to switch and to make some of the decisions that were needed, you know, around the registration fee.
You described doing it and then being just absolutely terrified because you didn't know what's going to happen once you took that turn to ditch the registration fee. And you couldn't tell really from the early returns what was going to happen.
And so we did kill the registration fee. But the first thing that happened was, you know, the number of locations were slower, the number of people mm-hmm. wanting to do anything or step outside. Some literally by law couldn't. And so all of that was happening simultaneously. And so we were nervous. Yeah, very much so. I said terrified. I was terrified because, you know, at the end of the day, we've got to cut payroll and look after our people and our partners from August 1st through the end of September. You know, it goes into that exponential run, and it wasn't exponentialing at all. It was just flatlining, like people were still on vacation. But when Labor Day, then even then, though, it was slow. And then it was an incredible rush to the finish. So whereas the year before we had 2.4 million raised in the ride, 1.15 got raised that year. So that was raised with significantly fewer participants. And that that was the first indication that the chafe, those who just wanted to kind of be around the event, were not interested in being there. I think your term is, you know, the consumers left in droves, and the constituents who bled for the thing, either the event and or the cause, showed up, and their hands were very high. Count me in. I mean, our pivot was to introduce something called freestyle. Here's like eight ideas that you could do to make this happen. It's not unique, but eight ideas. We called it freestyle. You chose it. We didn't connect it to any digital platform or anything. I would just choose it, do it, talk about it, share it. And, you know, at the end of the day, 75% of them still wanted to walk or ride their bikes. And actually, Kristen, who worked for us, you know, stole the IKEA phrase, you know, some assembly required, which we rolled out. I was brilliant, which is the story of that summer, right? And anything that kind of followed. And people are like, yeah, good. To tie into what you said, it gave them autonomy. It gave them some mass, like, okay, we'll do it. And sure enough, they did. And they, you know, they didn't go skydiving. They didn't do foolish things that we're aware of. They got at the fundraising, and it mattered more than anything. And then our relationship with our partners, our locations, our partners, so they come in through the event a little differently than other P2Ps. And so we just coached our partners on just communicating the essential needs that they had in the midst of COVID and not getting cute with it. You know, here's how it's affecting us. Here's how you could help. Please ride your bike. And away they went. killing the registration fee wasn't in isolation. Mm-hmm. What was also needed with that, and it, you know, may be instructive to anyone listening, is we also needed to address the fact that we had lost our nerve talking about fundraising in our events.
Oh, and so interesting.
The front page of our events would say walk, you know, register to walk. And so we changed that to register to fundraise. It's not about walking. As you say in your book, it was never about the bikes, right? From MS. Right. It's about something else. And so, you know, we committed to offending people over mm-hmm. the overt way we used and talked about fundraising at almost mm-hmm. every stage of it. And we just tried to do it with a cheekiness that hopefully they would find endearing. So then it set up that shift to go all in, frankly, and cast ourselves onto the net and see how the no registration fee would work. We saw a significant surge in gross revenue. Sponsorships were up huge. Everything was up, up, up. So go through our first year post-COVID was was what we call our 2021 CNOI. And we saw this, you know, 55% increase. And then the year after, it's up like 22%. Right. And this year, we were pinching ourselves with the increase. I mean, you just don't bet against the donor. The donor shows up almost. The donor is faithful. The donor will write the check. You know, dollar per donor went up a little bit for sure during COVID. But more than anything, if they were asked, they gave. It was excellent. and so, but it was such a surge. You know, we were waiting for this year to get, you know, some, you know, a big dip down. I was nervous again. I was a little nervous. You know, will we see a big decrease in the average donation from, you know, 84 to 74, or, you know, $10 times 130,000 donations is a big impact, obviously, on the event. So we were waiting for some of that stuff to drop, but the penny didn't drop this year.
Interesting.
It didn't drop. And what we especially track for sure is that, you know, of a pie, what percentage of our participants, so about 37,000 participants, what percentage of those participants in CNOY did no fundraising at all? You know, pre-COVID, it's at 34%, 35%. Pre-COVID and pre-no reg fee, it's at 35%, 33, 37, in that range, right? Depending. And suddenly this big shift, we lose, you know, the number of people per team falls. That's good, right? Because we're not looking for participants. We're looking for fundraisers. So that was good. 7.1 to 6.4 approximately per team. Great. And then the average that they were raising went up. Well, that's just math working. We get that. But then it went up more than the differential. So clearly something else happened. An awkward conversation was forced with each of our locations to have with each of their team captains, to have with each of those participants to go, why am I in this event? Is it to pay $25 or is it to help a family in my community that needs some support? And that happened. And so post-COVID, we were waiting for the penny to drop and it did not, Katrina. Otis, it didn't drop. The average donation was within 50 cents of prior year. So that's fantastic. And then there was a pretty big surge in new participants, new locations, big surge, people coming out of the woodwork. Let me get out of the house. Let me get out of post-COVID. So they're there. They're excited. So we expected that. And so the fundraising culture is fine-tuning, isn't it? And we double down on better training. We do a lot of stuff contributes to the lift, right? Sure. But that moment of decision at the gate, at checkout, it's not even a checkout. It's just, are you in? Yeah, thank you. It was on the beach in Florida. I'm like, we're doing this, but when will it be? So it's not the whole story by any means. Like, you guys would never pretend it is.
Yeah.
But I mean, everybody that registers can't dumb the thing down.
Brian, did you make a change with your recognition products as well, or was it just your reg fee? You know, and you mentioned you're giving away toques. Toques, for those who don't know, is a stocking cap to Canadians. So were you still giving away the branded toques?
Yeah. So in the early days of, so before in coldest night of the year, if you paid the $25, you got the toque. And by the way, toque is what it's called. So if you're calling it something else, you've got it wrong. Just it's not a stocking hat. It's not a beanie. It's a toque. T-O-U-Q-U. Anyway, that doesn't matter. So it was like toques were confetti. if you could fog a mirror and you look like you fundraised, you got a toque, or if you paid the fee. And, you know, like, so pre-COVID, 10,000 people pay out of 22,000 paid the reg fee. They're all wearing the toque. The toque is evidence of your commitment to this mission. Not that you cut a check for $25. So the swag, the only swag we have is that, Otis. It's at the $150 mm-hmm. level for participants, $75 for students.
You know that we shut down our product warehouse after going through that same emotional experience that you're describing. Yeah. It's like, holy crap, we're doing a bad thing. We're doing a bad thing. Yeah.
I thought that was really authentic, actually. I just read that. I was just rereading it again before this.
And with long lasting impact, because, you know, it's really hard. Otis, maybe you can describe, you know, once you establish a market relationship, how hard it is to get over it, which kudos to you, Brian. It sounds like you guys have managed that leap. But Otis, could you address that?
Well, you know, all the research tells us that market relationships crowd out social relationships.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, frankly, I'm not sure exactly why, but there's a lot of research from social psychologists that tell us that, which is, you know, why it's so challenging, as Katrina said, to go from a market kind of an event to a social event. You just don't pull that many people. And, you know, it may have something to do with what Brian was talking about. The people that were there for the market relationship, they kind of got weeded out during COVID. They just didn't come. And so you were left with the folks who were really involved in these social relationships that were there for the mission. And so that may have made it a little bit unusual and easier for you, Brian.
During COVID, once the rich fee was killed, those who didn't want to fundraise left. It meant the culture of fundraising was almost everywhere. It was ubiquitous, right?
Yeah.
And that mm-hmm. and so people that maybe would have raised 50, you kind of felt like they couldn't point to their friends who did nothing. They could only point to their leaders or other friends who were doing something more. And, you know, they're having this conversation in their head going, what am I about? Yeah. What am I going to do here?
Yeah. So I'm going to take us out of chapter four, and I'm going to take us to our next book, Brian, which is about the role of community and identity. Otis, can you talk a little bit about community and identity?
You know, people seek out different communities in order to develop their own sense of identity. So, you know, I may volunteer for a political party because I want to develop that part of my identity and so forth. And some parts of our identities become very, very important that way. You know, research shows that most of us have 8 or 9 identities that we feel are important to us. And so, again, we seek out these groups, we seek out community. And in seeking out this community and in engaging with people who are like us in these ways, it reinforces us socially. It's called the social validation feedback loop. And so what that does is it strengthens our identity and then makes it more likely that we're going to engage with the community again. So that's what this loop is. It goes round and round and round. It strengthens our identity and it makes us want to come back for more because, you know, social validation is extremely rewarding. And so, you know, being validated by others who have our beliefs, you know, is very important to us. And, you know, on the downside, it's why people get in these information bubbles, these social bubbles, where they just are engaging with people who are only like them, which is kind of the negative side of it.
Yeah. So, Brian, when you were describing the people in the toques and like suddenly they didn't have exposure to people who were not bought in, they were only exposed to this deeply committed kind of person that had to change the air.
I think it helped the conversations focus more on cause, you know, than it may have in the past. You've got basically smaller teams with a clear line of sight to the why be mm-hmm. why you're, you know, freezing your butt off for an hour in February, right?
Well, it's in my mind, building community is like one of the most important and one of the way that we can behave most opportunistically, because it is not really done very well by many organizations. We typically hit a technology gap when we try and do it. You know, virtual community is supplied by very few companies, most of whom are using our data for profit. So, you know, that's a problem. And yet that's where we see a lot of steps forward in community building. Faith communities are diminishing. You know, people are leaving faith communities and they're not replacing it with anything. And I think that's the opportunity, or that's an opportunity for nonprofit, is to step in and deliver community to people in the context of mission. And I think it is just a gift to humanity, because these people are happier, healthier, and they're also, of course, impacting the mission. Otis, what am I missing on community?
It's one of the things about Brian's event. People are out in the cold.
Yeah.
They're out in the cold. They're freezing their butt off, as Brian said, and they're not getting anything for it. And when somebody does that, they're in an extreme condition, they're uncomfortable, you know, it increases their belief in the mission, because unconsciously what's going on is, I'm not getting anything out of here. If I'm freezing my butt for nothing, I must really believe in this. You know, people seek out these kinds of meanings. The second thing is, you know, when they're in a community, most of the time when nonprofits think of community, they think of the people on their email list. This is our community. But this is a real community, because these individuals are engaging with each other as they're doing the event. And, you know, it's that engagement with other people in the community that's so important, that nonprofits haven't really connected with so far in terms of how important that is.
And what, you know, what translates in Sina, why that's, that is so lovely to experience and feel, is like any event with, you know, if there's at least 80 people there, there's enough buzz, you know, with some volunteers to get something going, you know, right? You don't have to be Susan B. Come on, right? For, you know, in terms of size, but, you know, 150, 200, 300, and everyone stops, everyone's taking selfies at the beginning, and it's cold, the sun's setting, you're walking, and everyone races out. You know this to be true, and we're very loud. But eventually there's separation, and there's a certain tiredness from talking, because you're walking, because I'm 61 and I'm not that in shape. And you stop thinking about yourself, and you start looking around, and you're seeing, because of the way the sun sets, you're seeing other people's in their homes, and you realize that you have a home, but you're thinking about the event. And this whole collective shuffling of 100 or 200 or 300 people begin to feel like, I think they begin in a certain type of community. And by the time they come back, they're actually in it in some way, you know, and so, you know, and something happens, you come back, you get your bowl of chili. I know this is going, but you know, your bowl of chili, you know, it's a single utensil, and you're standing like some of the folks on our streets that are enduring this. And those are, you're like, yeah, this matters. And I'm glad I did something, small though it may be. I know charity partners like to see community become other things. And so, you know, if it can translate into a wallet or time is precious right now amongst volunteers. And so a great social fundraising event can translate that way.
Yeah. So, you know, keeping along this line, what the place where we see most nonprofits not able to move forward is to provide the kind of community that you just described, where it's in the formation, now it's there, it maybe is changing in nature, but to extend it beyond the event so that these people have a connection to each other, not just to the mission and to the organization, but to each other after the event. That's where we're stuck. That's where we're stuck. Industry-wide, we are stuck. You know, where we see it happening in any degree is on Facebook, frankly. There are some platforms that provide a virtual community, but unless the population is already there, we don't see great uptake. So, you know, how do we give people this meaningful element in their lives more than once a year? How do we improve their lives? You know, forget about the people we're serving with a mission, but the people we're serving with the ability to be part of a community and to fundraise for the greater good. How do we serve them better? I ask everyone this. So if you don't have an answer, don't feel badly.
It's definitely for us going to be capacity. They want to keep talking. They want to get ahead of next year. And we're trying to build something efficient for them. And efficiency isn't about community.
We had an interesting experience a few years ago. We had the head of digital marketing for the Bernie Sanders campaign come to one of our events and spend a few days with us. And it was interesting how he described what they do in politics. He said, we get a list and we just hammer it. And then on election day, we throw the list away because that's it. That was all we cared about. Yeah. And we don't care about building any kind of community beyond election day. After they vote, that we're done. And, you know, we know a lot of nonprofits don't want to do that. And yet, you know, really they're doing that anyway, because they're not extending the community beyond whatever their event is.
We are sick of the event by the time it ends. I am sick of the event. Like, we're like exhausted. You know, you're like, that's enough of that event. And so I quite arrogantly, I'm speaking on behalf of Blue Sea, we quite arrogantly, and particularly me, answer the question, do you want to continue to connect with us? And we don't ask it, actually. We don't give them a shot. We don't even invite them in.
I'm terribly curious about how Blue Sea, you know, most organizations see social fundraising as the front door. They're the acquisition device for new donors, new fundraisers, meeting the community. And then they pretty efficiently move those donors and fundraisers into other revenue channels, you know, with major giving, middle giving, direct response. How do you manage that? Or do you do anything with that?
All the donations that happen through all of our events go through Blue Sea as the charity of record. So we are the legal entity that receipts and is responsible for those charities. And we survey a lot and talk to each of our locations and ask, what are you doing with it? And for our sort of $10 million plus charities, they usually have a pretty nuanced communication plan. They don't drop it into the general in outbox, and they think about how to communicate and shepherd, steward those forward. But to our mid and smaller size, and not to paint a brush just across the board, it's usually capacity or bench strength. They are struggling. They tend to just drop it into the hopper and they get the same old communication. And of course, not much translates out of that. So that's if I were to clear out my screen behind me, you'd see some strategies that we're thinking about putting in place to make that easier for our charities to be able to communicate and walk it through. Yeah.
One of the comparisons we make in our book is to compare a donor list purchased to a donor list generated by efforts like yours.
Yeah. You know, I think that's what it's hard to say all that. I don't care that I'm gushing. You guys are really, we really love this book. And so it's really validating. I'm sure you've had a lot of folks echo how I felt about it. You know, somebody who's been in here for 40 campaigns and to go, we have nothing to apologize for. We are answering the call. And you just put that so well. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. But really, we just simply reflected the community. You know, we ask people like you, what's your life like? What do you do? And what's happening? And we reflected it back.
Blue Sea grows as a result of the lift we bring to charities from a fundraising standpoint. And then we grow as we find and discover new charities and locations where there's this opportunity is presented to them to come into this franchise fundraising. I'm not pitching Blue Sea. I'm just saying that often peer-to-peer events are either seen as we could never do that. And that's our value proposition, but also, or quite often as just beneath their dignity to even entertain.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And it's just, you know, my goodness, how can you get 200 of your 200 people who kind of, you know, get 20 captains, 150 people who love those captains, and they're going to literally pay you for them to introduce you and to help you acquire donors. You made that case so well. It was inspiring.
Well, thank you. And, you know, speaking of pitching Blue Sea, I would much rather have you guys come in and run a peer-to-peer program for a nonprofit than have them stand it up from scratch. Half the reason to write the book was to convince people don't do that. It's too hard. You know, it's not magic, but it's close.
10 years ago, drafted this cheeky little article called, hey, why don't we do our own event and keep all the money? It basically tells the story in as cheeky of a way as possible that says, I think you shouldn't do it unless you've got, you know, bench strength. And bench strength, that'll stay. Because, you know, like a well-meaning board member, a group of people, you know this, you're so cheeky in your own book, you know, can will this thing forward. And then, but then year after year after year after year after year, staying current, watching the trends, not moving on, keeping it fresh, keep that. That is hard slugging work.
It is hard work. It, back in the bad old days when we were doing recognition programs, we had a client, you know, say that to us, like, we're going to do our own program. And we're like, that's great news. Let us help by sending you the project plan. It was great fun. You know, they're like, what? No, we can't. No. And that was just that one element. So multiply that by 100.
Yeah, just like you often, like I said, I just like it when you, you know, you speak the truth, you know, like, God help you. Your uncle wants to help you with the website or whatever some of those throwaway lines are, right? And that's, you know, like, hey, I've got an idea for a t-shirt. And we've all seen logos that are a disaster, right?
Yes.
Although I loved, by the way, that's been helpful for us. If I can, again, that whole discussion about the early Relay for Life and how that local flair actually made it better, made it stronger. Right.
Yes.
That was really helpful for us. Right. Cause we're trying to franchise in essence, these events across the country. Mm-hmm. But if there's not that, is there anything they could do or do they have to get it all from head office? Right.
Yeah.
So that's been really helpful for us thinking through, no, man, we've got to find as many ways as possible for that charity to run its flag up the flagpole and
love it. Shine. And I know we always teach the trifecta, but what Brian is talking about is giving people autonomy, which is part of what Otis calls the trifecta of satisfaction. Otis, you want to hit that?
People who are satisfied in most aspects, in some aspects of their life, doesn't have to be everything. They report having a sense of autonomy, that they're making their own decisions, they're self-directed, competence, which is they're doing something they feel like is important and they have an opportunity to do it well, and relatedness, so, which means they're connected to something bigger than themselves. And if you think about the event that Brian was discussing and the people's experience, they were getting those things in spades. Brian, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts.
Change starts with just one person, you. If today's episode got your gears turning, don't forget to share it with your network. And hey, why not drop us a review? Your review helps more people find us and spread the good. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Until next time, this is Katrina signing off from Seeding Social Good podcast by Turnkey. Stay inspired, keep making waves, and let's create a better world together.